Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Thursday morning. It is the third day of September, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you all with us. And we've got a lot to talk about. We always do. We'll get to it all, but we welcome your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. I'm sitting here, I'm talking, I'm getting ready to introduce Alan, and I realize I think I have like a floater in my eye. I just have this thing, Alan, that's just sort of going back and forth. And then I realize that I'm wearing dirty glasses.
Well, it could be the dirty glasses, or it could be a floater. And we can only hope that it will float right out.
Float right out. I think it's just filthy glasses is what it is. But, you have those, like, errant hairs that go through your eyes? Yeah.
Have you tried pulling your eyelid over your lower eyelid? And sometimes that helps get something that's in there out of there.
I'll do it during the break.
Yeah.
But, well, how are you? How's everything? Good?
Fine.
All right. Take that. Good morning. Welcome. Nice to have you here. We also welcome our good friend Jen Smith, Berkshire Eagle reporter. Hello, Jen. How are you?
I am also present. Been covering the reopening of schools, and I'm standing.
How's that going? The opening of schools.
I'm standing. Okay. No, I don't actually have to reopen them, so I'm much better off than the schools themselves. I give them all the credit in the world, and parents too.
Well, I'm sure we'll touch on that at some point this morning because there's a lot there as well. Daily Freeman publisher emeritus Ira Fussville joins us. Ira, good morning. How are you?
Joe, good morning. Nice to talk to you again. Keep an eye on those floaters. I've had them, and they were precursors to detached retinas. Now they don't have to be, but don't ignore them too quickly if they persist.
Well, you just told me now that I have a detached retina.
Don't
I will
do
go
that.
The rest of this morning no thinking I have charge. A detached retina.
Clean your glasses first, Joe. Just clean your glasses.
Yeah, I think the world may clear up if I because the puppy licks my glasses, and I got all the crap all over, but I think that may be the problem.
Trust me, I've had floaters, and it wasn't a detached retina, so
you just have those things.
I'm always a glass half empty kind of person.
Yeah, well, you're not like you're cranky or anything. Linda Ellerbe joins us. She is a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist who was one of the first women to anchor the national news. She is a groundbreaker in television news, and we are thrilled to have her on our program. Good morning, Linda Ellerbe. How are you?
I am fine, Joe, but, I had floaters, and it wasn't a detached retina. It wasn't even dirty glasses. It was cataracts, so you have that to look forward to, too.
Yay!
Well, I'm not an eye doctor, but I just play one on the radio. Joe, can I say and add my name to those who have already made these comments over the last months or so? But this is the first time I've been on with Linda Ellerbe, whose work I have admired and respected for a long time. And it's a treat to be on the panel with her and meet her, albeit virtually.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much. And I apologize to everyone in advance if I sound a little odd. As Joe knows, I was not on last week because I had strained vocal cords. And yes, you would not be the first to say that if I shut up once in a while, that might not have happened.
Well,
but I'm delighted to be on with you, sir.
I am glad.
You sound terrific.
Yeah, I'm glad you saved up your vocal cord energy for us. I'm thrilled by that. So, well, welcome all. It's very nice to have you. A reminder to join in on the fun. For all of you wonderful listeners, all you have to do is email us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Hey, did you hear we're going to have a vaccine by late October, early November? Yep, the CDC says so. The president is pushing the possibility of a vaccine this year, and the CDC has outlined technical scenarios to state public health officials for an unidentified vaccine A and vaccine B. Ira, it's much like Match Game. Would you like A or B?
Yeah, I'd like to know a lot more about this vaccine other than the rather odd timing that they think it's going to be ready just before Election Day.
But, very I'm sure just a coincidence.
People who don't want to wear masks, how many people are going to take a chance on a vaccine that they may be unproven?
The CDC has notified public health officials in all 50 states and five large cities to prepare to distribute a coronavirus vaccine to healthcare workers and other high-risk groups as soon as late October or early November. The new CDC guidance is the latest sign of an accelerating race for a vaccine to ease a pandemic that has killed more than 184,000 Americans. The documents were sent out on the same day that President Trump told the nation in his speech to the Republican National Convention that a vaccine might arrive before the end of the year. Alan, I want you to comment on this, but I also want to say just about 20 minutes ago, the president tweeted, Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York has the worst record on death and China virus. 11,000 people alone died in nursing homes because of his incompetence. Could it not be said that 186,000 people so far have died due to the president's incompetence, number one? And number two, seeing that is why we're seeing this rush for a vaccine.
Yes, and yes, you can hear me, right?
Yeah, I can.
Okay. Yes, yep. And the first thing I want to say is das vidanya. In other words, the Russians put theirs out. The Russians put theirs out there without full testing, and darned if their best buddy isn't going to do the same thing now. It is incomprehensible that anybody that we have watched talk about what we should be putting into our bodies that makes no sense at all, that has been dismissed by everybody, and now the same guy is going to tell us that we should have an unproven vaccine before it is technically ready to go. Now, look, there are a lot of anti-vaxxers. There are a lot of people in this country who are just suspicious of vaccines, as Ira just mentioned, to begin with. And so you can just see how this is going to cripple, when we do get a vaccine, the process that will be necessary to have. So I'm saying this is nothing new for this president, and it is really and truly and absolutely despicable. What else?
So I want to go. Well, what else is I want before I go to Linda? I also want to ask you about. I mean, what do you think people will buy it? In the sense of, you know, I mean, so far the polls have said no. I think only 40% of the people said that they would actually take it. But then you get into a whole thing of, will it A, actually be available by them? That's questionable. B, who will it actually be accessible to? B, and then, you know, if you are able to take it, will you?
Who are we talking to?
You. I'm talking to you.
Good. Okay. Who do you think you're talking to? So the answer to me is that all the things I just said. But in addition, I want to go to your Cuomo point. Cuomo has been giving Trump a very hard time. And the reason he's been giving him a hard time is that the state desperately, and all of the states, desperately need the money to do what they need to do. $16 billion behind in New York State. And so the one thing about Cuomo is he doesn't fool around when it comes to something he really needs and the state really needs. And he's been giving it to Trump both barrels, and that's the reason that Trump has decided to take the gloves off.
Wendell Erby.
Okay, well, I think that this government trying to be prepared for anything is a good idea, but I would just like to say that the decision, let's review a little. The decision in the beginning to do nothing in hopes the virus would go away, do we remember? It will just disappear. One day we'll wake up and it will be gone. Was made for political reasons and had horrible consequences. The decision to reopen businesses in late May, early June, political reasons, bad consequences. The decision to reopen colleges, same thing. The decision to put out a vaccine before the election is obviously political and will come with consequences, but he doesn't have to put out a vaccine before Election Day. He merely is going to announce that he has a vaccine and it will be coming next week, and it will, you know, it's here and I've got it and no one else has it and I've got it. That's it. He has been so far pretty successful with the big lie. This is one more big lie.
Jen.
None of this is based on medical evidence. Not one decision from the very beginning of this virus has been made on medical evidence.
Well, that's
by this administration.
That's a great point. I mean, almost all public health officials are saying that this isn't going to work and this isn't going to happen, but and are very concerned about moving forward with a vaccine that hasn't been properly tested. Jen.
The most extraordinary story that I read, Joe, was a story in The Atlantic that the nation has, I don't even know how to phrase this, run out of monkeys for tests. And that is why drug companies are, they can't actually get any more rhesus monkeys for testing. And it's always preferable, whether you believe in animal testing or not, for human disease, it is preferable to test on monkeys first as part of the chain. They are the last test before it goes to humans. What is happening here in the rush to get the vaccine out is testing has gone straight to humans, bypassing the last step before it.
We're running out of monkeys. My
hey,
God.
That's amazing.
We're running out of toilet paper. You know that?
Now we've run out of monkeys.
I just throw that in this morning.
There's a chain
we are
shortage.
We're running out of rhesus monkeys. Rhesus monkeys.
Go ahead, Jen. I'm sorry. We're getting punched drunk
so
early.
There's so much to say about this, and you know, I mean, that's my job is looking at evidence and facts, and there's just nothing is adding up. And so you have this idea of a vaccine that's being rushed, and that's a big pharma race. Let's put that out there right like that. And at the same time, we have talks about these rapid test kits also coming out this month that's supposed to be deployed to by the millions to states. So, you know, first we're not even done testing people, and then we're going to vaccinate on that with trials that haven't even been conducted. So the priority for getting out the testing, the rapid test, includes students and school staff. Yet the pharmaceutical companies have really delayed trials on children and pregnant women and women who are breastfeeding, are some of our most vulnerable populations as well. And so there's this big juxtaposition with that. I think one of the questions that stands out in my mind is, you know, the country, the federal government is investing millions of dollars into quote unquote Operation Warp Speed, which is the Trump administration's vaccination initiative. Yet we're still talking about charging people for tests, which is also a great concern of equity. So if we can pump millions of dollars into big pharma to develop these things, but yet we're still asking people to pay. And that's anywhere, I've seen figures anywhere from $4 to $50 out of people's own pockets. And, you know, that's concerning too, among the many other things, monkey chain supply included.
You know, I was asking Alan this question, but I mean, even if it's available, how many people are going to take it? I mean, it is.
Well, and that's another concern. And how do you know you're taking the right thing? You know, same. So there's this push right now to have the flu shot available to everyone, especially to get kids
right.
Their flu vaccination before this starts. And so, you know, my question is that children require a smaller dose than adults. So is that even going to be available? Is that actually feasible? That's one of my questions. Will this new vaccination, are they testing it in conjunction with the flu shot? Will there be any adverse interactions? Again, we don't know the effects on people. So it's not just about people who are anti-vaxxers. I think there are some very legitimate questions about these vaccines that are being pushed through at a rate and at a speed that we don't know, that's been unprecedented for vaccine development.
Well, good that point. Depends on who is touting the vaccine. I mean, if we hear from Dr. Fauci, there's a vaccine, and trust me, it's a good one and it works, that's going to be a lot different in terms of people deciding to take the vaccine than if Donald Trump has a press conference and says, take the vaccine. So, I think people have a right and should be wary of it, if for no other reason, the speed that it's been developed. But there is a possibility if people who are trusted say it's worth taking. I think there's the only thing that good that I see short term here is the notion of there being an attempt to make a plan for when there is a vaccine. Here's how it's going to be rolled out. I would much rather they start talking about that now than the day after the vaccine is developed and they say, OK, we've got a vaccine. Who's online first? So there should be a plan for that.
Alan?
Joe, I did have one thing to say. We are talking about all those people who might not take the vaccine. But how about the people who do? In other words, there will be some people who take that vaccine based on either their Republicanism or the fact that they trust the president or whatever happens. And we have seen drugs that have been untested do terrible things to people in the past.
That's right.
So my point is there will be some people taking that vaccine.
Well,
and those are the people we have to worry about here.
And so far, what the CDC said yesterday is that the initial plan is distributed to healthcare workers, which I think is scary, and other high-risk groups. So If it's the people on the front lines that are taking that are the guinea pigs in this, I think that obviously is concerning as well.
Well, and let's talk about those guinea pigs for a moment. So
just have about a minute, but go ahead.
Yeah. So there needs to be when you talk here and from many of the companies, there needs to be 30,000 to 60,000 people tested in these trials. And so far, they haven't completed all of that. And we don't know the genetic makeup of folks. We don't know their racial backgrounds or other demographics. So there's a lot more at play in this. And even if Dr. Fauci does endorse a vaccine, I'm also curious what other considerations are taken into just the demographics and the population that this vaccine could affect and how.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have a lot of letters on this, and I haven't looked at them, so I don't know where they're headed, but we got a lot of them. So we'll work our way through those when we come back. We welcome your letters as well. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Ira Fussfeld, and Linda Ellerbe on the roundtable this morning. We'll continue our conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Thursday morning. As I mentioned, we have a lot of letters, so we'll get to as many of those here over the next few moments. We begin with Marie, who says Trump and his family should be the first in line to get this vaccine for coronavirus. He's so positive about it. Let's see if that would happen. We go to Sarah, who says, although unintentional, you're all parroting anti-vax rhetoric and fueling irrational fear around vaccinations. How would a flu vaccine possibly interact with other vaccines? This type of speech is why there are more and more people illogically railing against vaccines and putting us all at risk. So with respect to Sarah and to her letter, I'm wondering where the illogical part comes in if a vaccine seems to be being rushed, if it seems to be foregoing some of the very important testing before it goes to before it comes to market to the public, and if that is illogical, Alan.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't like the letter. It's not, because what it does is it suggests that we are doing something that is not quite right here. We are. We're saying there's a reason that all these tests were established for vaccines. There's a reason that the government says before we let anybody take it, we want to test it. So to say that what we're doing here is coming up against or presenting a rational approach to vaccine taking is just ridiculous. And I mean, the fact is that the CDC itself set up the rules, and now the CDC, under political pressure, is foregoing those rules. End of statement.
Jen.
Yeah, you know, and I said it as I was speaking in our just a few minutes ago too, that this is different than just anti-vaxxer language, so to speak, in that these are legitimate questions that are being raised by the medical community. It's the people who are in charge of vetting and administering these vaccines. It's not just this is my opinion. This is legitimately being brought up as these trials are happening in a very rapidly moving real time.
Linda?
Well, I think we all need to remember in all of our thinking about this vaccine is that we have been saying for months, well, you know, schools will it'll be safe when we have a vaccine, safe to reopen the schools, safe to leave our houses, safe to not wear a mask. When we have a vaccine, we need a reality check. The coronavirus is not going away instantly with a vaccine. You would need millions and millions and millions of doses all over the world before you would. Even if a vaccine comes out in October, and it is, let's say it works, it'll be months that people will still get sick and die, and months before we even know if it works.
Well, and that's a great point, because there's a big difference between a vaccine and a cure.
Yes.
Ira.
There's a great difference between a vaccine and people stopping dying. And as Jen pointed out, there are all these barriers with a vaccine, as Ira has pointed out. I don't believe that we are fools to be skeptics here.
And I think I just wanted to add that we know that vaccines are not 100% effective. And it has to do with the strain that you're developing a vaccine for. And we know that the novel coronavirus is not so novel in that it's changing. We see that research out there now. You know, flu vaccines are, you know, created each year for certain strains. And again, they're only so effective. So you do have to ask these questions.
Ira?
You know, I'm thinking a lot these days when I think about this vaccine, about my venerable childhood. And Alan, and I think Linda could relate to this. We grew up in those early days when families were frightened about getting their children getting polio.
No question.
And then the Salk vaccine came along. Salk, Dr. Jonas Salk, S-A-L-K, I may be mispronouncing it. And I vaguely remember lining up in my public school with all the other kids, and we dutifully got our vaccine, and we were protected from getting polio. And what I don't remember was whether there was the same discussion. Is it too soon for the polio vaccine? And even if it's not, I don't want my kid to get the polio vaccine. My recollection is we were thrilled that there was a vaccine. Polio was going to go away, and we all took the vaccine. But it was a different world then. We trusted our government. And again, I don't remember how much testing there was before that vaccine was approved to be used. But that was just a memorable time in my life, and I was awfully young, and I still remember it.
You know, Ira makes a very, very good point here, and that is by Trump fooling around with the way that he has been doing, it really does engender in people a distrust of medicine. If he's telling us to take bad drugs, put stuff in our bodies that will clearly not work, and now he's telling us this.
Man.
This is really a terrible thing.
It really is. Linda.
Well, I remember, along with Ira, I remember the polio. I remember being with my parents in Houston, Texas, and we were driving, and we passed a big building, had tents all outside, and people milling around in these tents. And I asked my parents what was going on, and they said, that's a hospital. And those are all parents camped out in those tents around the hospital because they can't see their children. It's too contagious. And the doctor comes out once a day and reads the list of who's alive and who's dead. As a child, that terrified me. I remember getting the vaccine the minute the Salk vaccine was available. And I don't know, some people, about a year later, they gave it to kids on sugar cubes. No, I got the shot. It was the first year. It is an interesting question how much testing was done before that, but it goes right to the issue of trust, as you're saying. I've just lost any faith at this point in most of the government, because most of the government has been corrupted and tainted at the moment.
Mm. Let's go back to the letters. We go to Amy, who says, there are those of us who will probably be forced to take the Trump vaccine. Albany Med fires the employees who won't take the flu vaccine. You can bet the threat will be the same regarding a poorly tested COVID vaccine. By the way, I don't know that that's true, that Albany Med fires the employees who won't take the flu vaccine. So just to say that. It is easy to say go work elsewhere, but there are too many of us vested there and have local commitments or contracts there. The hospital staff who were called heroes will now be called guinea pigs. Nice, isn't it? Asked Amy. Sarah says, although unintentional, you're all... we did that one. I apologize. John said, meanwhile, on the opposite side of the planet, Radio New Zealand talked about a COVID-19 vaccine on one of their programs yesterday. Their discussion was about whether we're all deluding ourselves about a vaccine. They've asked a virologist whether a vaccine was even possible at all, considering that a vaccine has never been created for any coronavirus of any type. Then they went on to talk about the difficulties around creating such a vaccine and what could go wrong. Compare and contrast, says John. Interesting point. And also, I think it's worth noting, too, isn't it, Alan, that the president and the administration had an opportunity. They spurned the WHO in working on their vaccine plan. So it's hard to think that, you know, even looking at just of what's best for the people, that seems to be put aside.
Apparently, that's the last thing on his agenda. Yeah. Best for the people. What's number one is the re-election, and, you know, and what's best for him. And he knows that if he can, look, we're playing with the margins right now. If he can say, we have a vaccine, there will be some people, not me, but there will be some people who believe it, right? And we'll say, okay, I'm going to vote for him now that he's done this. I didn't like what he was doing with COVID, but it turns out he's been able to make it work. And how many of those there will be, I don't know, but how many do you need? Let's say it's 5% of the people. There could be the election right there.
Right. Ryan writes,
you posed the question to Alan about what Trump said about Cuomo after Cuomo unleashed on him last night. We saw the familiar angry Andrew last night. What was it Dan Richards said about H.W. Bush? He can't help it. He's got a silver spoon. He was born with a silver spoon in his mouth.
Right.
Trump can't help it. He's trying to stay away from talking about this virus. He's turned his campaign to a law and order campaign. And what does he do? He points to 11,000 deaths and lays them at Cuomo's doorstep. And I think we can debate whether or not that's accurate, but let's just say it is accurate. So let's subtract the 11,000 from the 186,000 others, in total, right, rather, and we'll pin 175,000 on Trump while he'll pin 11,000 on Cuomo. He just can't help it. He has no discipline, and it's just amazing that he has the support he has.
Kara asked a simple question.
Historical note, Ira.
Yes.
When Ann Richards at the convention said, poor George, he was born with a silver foot in his mouth. I'm a Texan. I can
silver foot.
That was not her line. I was there, and I know exactly who wrote the line and gave it to Ann. It was Lily Tomlin. I'm friends of both women. And it was the day before the speech at the convention. Lily said, Anne, try this.
Who wrote that she could do anything Ginger Rogers could do anything.
Ginger Rogers did everything Fred Astaire did, only backwards and wearing high heels.
Right. Yeah. Another great Anne Richards line.
Anne did not write that, and I did not write that, and it was attributed to me for a long time. I did give the line to Anne. I heard the line on an airplane from a woman in front of me. She said it. I have no idea who originated that. I told it to Anne. Lily and I sat there. We watched two things we had given her show up in the speech, and we were thrilled and we were proud. And we kept silent.
Great line from Broadcast News.
Did you like the play that the one woman played by Holland Taylor? Did she get her?
Ann Richards.
I very much did. Yeah. I thought she held Anne's soul in her hand in that play.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation again. Many more letters about vaccines and schools and all that stuff, and then we'll move on to other topics as well. We have Alan Chartok, Jen Smith, Ira Fussfeld, and Linda Ellerby on the program this morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Bob writes, there is a larger issue. This perversion of the CDC to announce a vaccine at this time, that's all in shouty caps, is yet another attack on a previously honorable government organization formerly trusted.
Absolutely right.
We go to Ryan. If we're lucky, the first vaccines will be safe. We'll have no idea how effective they might be. The population will effectively become the phase 3 trial group because the phase 3 trials cannot possibly be completed. Kara asks, where is Dr. Fauci? Well, he showed up yesterday. He was talking about this and his concerns about the Labor Day weekend. He was out yesterday speaking. Nita says, Trump is eager to risk our lives with an untested warp speed vaccine for his political benefit. He is inhumane. Nothing new here. We also go to Russell, this on Trump and Cuomo. Would anyone on your panel like to comment on Cuomo's remarks regarding President Trump? Specifically, there aren't enough bodyguards for him to be safe walking the streets of New York City. Anybody?
Are we sure he said that?
That case, Trump said it?
No.
Yeah, I think Ray had it on the news earlier. I thought it was very ill-considered of him. That's why I refer to him as the angry Andrew. I mean, you guys up there know him better than I do, but that's the side of Andrew that's sometimes tough to take, and he did walk it back a little bit.
He said he had better have an army to protect him if he comes to New York City.
There used to be, there was the old Andrew, we knew that. Then there was the new Andrew, who we all loved, you know, we watched him every day and watched what he did. But sometime there's a reversion to the old Andrew. I mean, one of them is this business of getting rid of the Working Families Party. You know, that's the old Andrew, trust me.
Nina writes, Dr. Salk tested the vaccine on his own son. Remember also he did not patent it so that it was widely available for a very low cost. Kathy says, in regards to the commentary on vaccines, I have a friend who is an infectious disease doctor, and he himself has stated that he will be waiting until sometime in 2021 before he gets vaccinated. Then we go to Russell, which I think is a repeat of a letter I wrote earlier. Question for Jen Smith and the panel. Schools are struggling to reopen. I'd like to point out that there are 7 days a week and 365 days a year. Why are we trying to make schools reopen in a non-pandemic framework and not utilize the 25% to 40% of available days? Jen, would you like to take a crack at that one?
I think we need a whole show for that one. But, you know, what I can say, I mean, you know, just looking at school reopening plans across Berkshire County, the plans vary widely. It's very dependent on what your school has looked like. You know, today, this afternoon, I'm going over to a school that has under 60 children. And so they're facing a different dynamic than schools that have thousands of kids potentially in the building. So you really do have to look at it case by case in terms of expanding the school year and using different days. You know, I think a lot of what comes into play is sort of pressure from families, pressure from the economy to get family members back to work. And schools are the places that allow that. And so you really have to understand all of those dynamics at play and why I think there is this pressure to do something. And I think there's a lot of creative responses to that, whether it's hiring other tutors, doing a school pod at home. You know, there's a lot of things that are changing literally by the hour.
Jen, would you send your kid to school now?
I think it depends on, you know, who my child was. I think as I talk with families, especially families of children with special needs and children with who are just younger and who depend on that in-person interaction for developmental sake, I'd plan that decision differently. If I had a high schooler who is, you know, capable of independent study, and I felt like they had access to a robust program, I'd say remote learning is fine for them. But I think if you need occupational therapy, if you need, more intense services, if you require that, then if there's a safe way to do it, I think that's something to be considered as well.
We have this letter from Kathy, who says, so let me get this straight. The CDC will take a fresh off the assembly line vaccine, not thoroughly tested, and get it to our frontline essential caretakers, doctors, nurses, EMTs, etc. And what if the outcome is a bad one? What a time. But again, Alan, I mean, it seems like we're going back and forth on this, but it does, you know, this is what he's saying he wants, but you know, he also wanted us all to be back to work. You know, the virus would be away by Easter. So, is any of this really going to happen?
Well, I don't know. But I know one thing. He's used up his credibility.
Yeah.
Nobody believes what this guy says anymore, and nobody should. We know what it's the...
If that were true. Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Okay, you're right. You're right, Linda. When I say nobody, I mean me. You're right. There are a lot of people who believe this stuff, and your correction is well taken.
Let me play devil's advocate. For those of us who still watch TV, and for those of us who specifically watch the evening news, and notice that almost all the commercials are for miracle drugs, or not miracles, they're for drugs, legitimately yes. sold drugs. And then at the very end, they list all of the potential side effects that could occur, maybe even including death. With that as a backdrop, does that make it less likely that people will ignore the vaccine? In other words, they're already taking drugs, many people, that have side effects that could be potentially disastrous. Well, why not just add a vaccine? Because on the other hand, it may prevent you from getting the virus. Is that a fair analogy? Well,
no, because the FDA clearly has tested those other drugs, right? In other words, they have to go through hoops. Yes,
it'll help it'll help solve your problem, but it could cause all of these other things.
Yeah, but you had to get in the front door to begin with. Is my point. Do you understand that? Yeah.
I mean, and it's a much
right.
larger.
And I think that's...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that's the other difference between a heart medication trial of something that was out and what's happening now, because what's happening now is under emergency order. And so those standards are dipped then lower than the normal process.
Because it does seem, Ira, that even if, to Alan's point, I mean, even if getting through the door, at least they've been tested and you know what the percentages are and you have an idea of what the side effects are, where here the testing would be incomplete and you don't know what they are, right?
Well, I think we got to find some more monkeys.
I'm fascinated
by
Linda's.
I believe we may be making monkeys of ourselves.
Yeah.
He's making monkeys of us. We are the new rhesus monkeys, people.
So what we do know is that the CDC is preparing two vaccines, and that is what they're We don't, in the planning documents that have been sent, I mentioned this vaccine A and vaccine B. The technical details include the time between doses and storage temperatures, match well with the two vaccines furthest along in U.S. clinical tests. Pfizer is making one, Moderna is making the other. Some experts are concerned about what they see as a rushed process. Still, public health experts agree that agencies at all levels of government should urgently prepare for what will eventually be a vast, complex effort to vaccinate hundreds of millions of Americans. I think one of you said this earlier, right? That, you know, to plan and to have to be ready for a good vaccine is a good thing to do, to be ready for that, just to make sure that it is a vaccine that's been fully tested. No one wants to take credit for that.
Right. Okay. And I think, like, from a logistical standpoint of vaccinating a large amount of people all at once is going to create a lot of challenges. And I think what's happening with the flu shot mandates in Massachusetts, so for example, there's a mandate for children to be vaccinated to get a flu vaccine before the end of December. And so to have this influx of people getting vaccine and getting them in a place that's prepared to do that is going to be a challenge.
We should note that while these two vaccines are the ones that show the greatest promise to be pushed ahead, there are 34 other vaccines in clinical trials worldwide. There are over 90 more vaccines confirmed to be in active preclinical testing. Over the next year, clinical trials are planned for 69 of them. And that's to your point, Linda, of it's going to be a long time before we cure this and know what works best.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. I'm just agreeing with you. That's fine. That's okay. All right. We'll go.
you refer to A and B as the match game, and I think it's important to decide if you want the Gene Rayburn match for game or the Alec Baldwin match game.
Well, I think you know me. I think you know me well enough, Ira, to know exactly which match game I want.
Yes, exactly. With the long microphone.
Yes, Mr. Rayburn was the best. Love your show. Linda Ellerbe and Alan are treasures. Fascinating stories told this morning about polio. I'm at UAlbany alum here in Del Mar. I recall the president of my university being very visible around campus as he had polio crutches. And I just learned through a new adoptee rights law that O'Leary, that this doctor, Dr. O'Leary, is a cousin, and that from Beth. Marion says the people who are routinely forced to get vaccines are school children and college students. These are the people least in need for their own personal health, but the desire to attend school will be persuasive. An untested vaccine would be dangerous for our youth. We're going to take a break there. When we continue, when we come back, we'll continue. We'll talk more about many other subjects that are making news, and then we'll include your letters as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Linda Ellerbe, Ira Fussfeld, Jen Smith. Alan Chartok was with us. Alan had an appointment and had to leave early, so we thank him, but he left. So we have Jen and Ira and Linda, and we go to this story from the New York Times, which is titled, Trump says some really strange things. Republicans say no comment again. Even by the whiplash standards of a Trump news cycle, the president said some startling things in an interview with Laura Ingraham on Fox News on Monday and Tuesday night. To name a few, a plane almost completely loaded with thugs wearing black uniforms had come to Washington last week to disrupt the Republican National Convention. The president's opponent in the 2020 campaign, former Vice President Joe Biden, was being controlled by, quote, people that you've never heard of, people that are in the dark shadows, end quote. Police officers like the one in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who shot an unarmed black man seven times last week, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down, have a hard time with pressure. And so, quote, they choke just like in a golf tournament. They miss a 3-foot putt. It has become customary when reporting on President Trump to point out the obvious. These would all be rather astonishing claims coming from any other president or major candidates for office. But they were hardly astonishing enough for any leading House or Senate Republicans to have anything to say about it. None cared to comment, at least not the dozen or so the New York Times tried to reach on Tuesday. This is also a familiar pattern, writes the Times, Mr. Trump saying something incendiary while his fellow Republicans say nothing. If the leader comments, I'll be sure to pass it along, said Scott Sloofman, a spokesman for Senator Mitch McConnell. As of late Tuesday afternoon, there was nothing to pass along. Granted, neither the House nor Senate is in session this week, and members are back in their districts. This spared them the indignity of having to scurry away down the halls of the Capitol, escaping into fake phone calls or protesting that they were late for lunch or had missed the president's statement, had not seen his tweet, did not watch the interview, or whatever. Only the Times does point out that so far the only person to say anything about this was Senator Mitt Romney, which should not be that much of a surprise. So how worried should we be? I mean, it seems like there's a second line or second paragraph in the article, Linda, where it basically, well, you know, we expect this. We're not surprised by this. And yet, shouldn't it still be shocking?
It should be shocking. It's not after 3.5 years of this. It's just ridiculous. But this is what he does. It's the big lie. It's the historical big lie. You say it often enough, you say it loud enough, eventually it gets accepted as truth. And the fact that the Republicans in the Senate and in the House, but especially the Senate, okay, because they have stopped so much, the fact that they don't comment speaks directly to a lack of spine, to cowardice, if you will, and to putting their own reelections before the country. The same thing Trump is doing, the Republican Senate has done. And I'm going to stop right now and say that if you go on Act Blue, you can give $10 to defeating Mitch McConnell, who is up for reelection in 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And I personally am giving a few bucks every week. And give to his opponent, Amy McGrath.
Amy McGrath running against Mitch McConnell.
That lying, spineless coward needs to go away, along with his fellow in the White House, who he doesn't really agree with, but Trump has been very useful to the Republicans, who've had an agenda since Reagan of doing away with Social Security, cutting Medicare. He's followed all their, he's helped them. He has helped them. Trump has helped McConnell in the Federalist aims, stated aims. He's been their willing puppet. But they got more than they bargained for, and they can't figure out what to do it. So what do? They shut up as though saying nothing were okay.
How do you think saying nothing, Ira, will impact their reelection chances?
Well, the whole thing sort of takes my breath away. Just when you think that he's said the most ridiculous thing possible, he'll come up with three or four more. And sort of to sidebar your question, which I'll get back to it, is the appearance by Attorney General Barr on Wolf Blitzer's
yes.
program yesterday was just startling. I mean, we've known that Barr has crossed the line relative to being too close to Trump and then being the top law enforcement official in the country. He's already edged towards Trump. But yesterday, in terms of questions like the supposed thugs on the airplane and the safety of voting by mail, they continue to drill these theories into people's heads, and we know, because we've been saying it dozens of times on this program, if not more, there's between 35% and 40% of this country who will follow them anywhere. And so to your question, one can only hope that middle, which is what they're fighting for, that's where the election is going to be determined, that middle, many of whom went to Trump the last time, are going to see the error in their ways and see through these people and say, the hell with you guys, you're ruining our country. Because if they don't, if we're subjected to another 4 years of this, this country will not look like anything like the country we all grew up in.
Jen.
You know, I think what I will add is, you know, when you look at what's being said and how it's being said and how that translates, you know, show me a place where there's ever a good outcome. You know, this sounds eerily like the things that authoritarians like, you know, Turkey's President Erdogan or Syria's President Bashar al-Assad spoke in similar fashions, and those are not model countries and societies by any means. And add that to what else is going on in this country. It doesn't lead good places.
This maybe goes without saying, but I feel we should just say it anyway, which is that the president then, while saying these things that, as Ira rightfully said, it can take your breath away, you also have him questioning the mental capacity of the former vice president and his opponent, Joe Biden. You have him wanting to take a drug test prior to the debates. And that just seems bizarre to me, too. I maybe that shouldn't seem odd either, but it does, because I don't know how you would ever think, if you're saying these things yourself, that maybe you not bring up the mental issue. Linda?
Well, he's doing it entirely to take attention off questioning his health, physical and mental.
Yeah.
Did he have strokes? Little mini strokes last year. You know, we all watched him walk down the plank. We have all seen him lose his way. What better than to say, well, you did it first, and you too. Please, it's childish.
But do you think that works? In other words,
By
going after Biden, he's drawing more attention to the issues regarding himself.
Right.
I sure do hope so.
Yeah.
It's good I'm not a journalist anymore. It's also fun.
Let's see. So let's go on to other subjects, if you all don't mind. Again, we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We'll get to some of those in just a minute. While we're talking about the campaign, let us talk about a new this new wave of polls and that they are showing Joe Biden maintaining a steady but not overpowering lead, particularly in the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania. But there are also these dueling ads that are going on about the law and order and who is tougher on this. The New York Times writes, President Trump and Joe Biden clashed on Wednesday in dueling remarks with the new advertisements about public safety and the outbursts of violence in some American cities as the presidential campaign entered an aggressive new phase with the parties tussling over both the issues and the electoral map they are being fought on. The collisions came as a wave of new polling gave the first significant snapshot of the race since the Democratic and Republican conventions last month. The polls showed that Mr. Biden still holds a steady, if not overwhelmingly, tight enough to give Democrats cause for concern and Republicans room for hope, particularly in the key battleground of Pennsylvania. Polls by Fox News on Wednesday showed Mr. Biden leading in Arizona, North Carolina, and Wisconsin, all states that Mr. Trump won in 2016. While the president has a dwindling number of days to reset a race in which he has consistently trailed this year, Democrats are still wrestling with the asymmetrical nature of battling a candidate willing to make outlandish and false statements in pursuit of victory. Asterisk, see our former conversation. Ira.
I have to always give the admonition that there's just so much time left. It's 2 months is a lifetime. I can tell you that when I see Biden speak, I just hold my breath and hope he's not going to say something stupid. We're all sort of anticipating that that's bound to happen. You have the debates coming up. But here's something that I think anytime a talk show or a news show or a story has to do with the election and what's going to happen on election day, we need to hammer to people, don't expect to have a final vote on election night. There are going to be countless number of mail-in ballots that may well change the election. If I refer you to a program I saw the other night called Axios on HBO, where they interviewed someone who is an analyst regarding voting, who fully expects that the map of the U.S. on election night might be entirely red, and that 2 or 3 weeks later that Biden will have won the election. And if that happens, and if people are not anticipating that happening because of their knowledge that they're going to be counting absentee ballots, then people will think the election has been rigged. Why? Because Trump has been telling people that the election is going to be rigged. So we have to let people know as often as we can, don't look for the traditional election night results. Don't put away your popcorn and your beer. This thing is going to last at least a few more weeks after Election Day.
Well, first of all, I'm not putting away my popcorn or my beer, but I do want to say that there was an interesting article in the New York Times that was saying many political analysts and prognosticators were saying the same thing about, and Jen, you can speak to this, about Massachusetts and during their primary, that we would not know for days whether it was Markey or Kennedy. We would not know for days whether it was Richard Neal or Alex Morse. And we knew by 10 o'clock.
Let me ask a question of both of you, if I may. I'm sorry, Jen, you go ahead.
Well, go ahead, Jen, and then when.
Oh, that was mostly what I want to say. We're also, you know, tallying votes in Massachusetts is a little different than tallying votes in Texas.
No, I understand
or
California. That, but we were concerned about it.
Yeah, but yeah, and I think, you know, things will still come in, but I think it's sort of hard to tell with comparing a state primary race with a presidential one as well.
Wenda.
Well, I think we all have to be aware of the fact, we all know that Trump is trying to rig the election, trying to discourage mail-in voting, trying to mess with the post office so it messes it up. What if we have to be aware that possibly on election night, if Trump is leading by a little, what happens if he declares victory and then we have a Florida situation and he doesn't want to count the mail-in votes? Who makes them still be counted?
Mm.
What are we prepared to do in that case? If he
declares, well, and I think to that, the public must be braced for this to not be settled on a winner on election
yes.
night. And the analysts I referred to in mm-hmm. that Axios program, for whatever reason, likelihood of the Democratic candidate getting more support in mail-in votes because of the makeup of people who are likely to vote by mail is significant, and that the red state voters are going to vote in person overwhelmingly, and their votes will be counted sooner. But Linda's question is really important, and what's going to happen if he declares victory, which he's likely will if in that position.
Also, yesterday, the president, let us not forget this, the president suggested that North Carolina residents should try to vote twice, by mail and in person, which I believe is voter fraud, but he suggested it in the election, encouraging them to test the state's mail-in voting system, making the comments to a news station in Wilmington, North Carolina. The reporter asked if he's confident in the state's voting system, which could see 600,000 absentee votes cast this fall. Linda.
Well, I mean, it's I don't even know what to respond to this. It's all become ridiculous, but true. And as Ira points out, I get up every morning, I read the news, I turn on NPR when I get up, and I read the news, I read in. And every morning I think, every night I go to bed thinking, well, we can't go any lower. Every morning I get up and discover we have.
I'll tell you one
thing.
As much as he's critical of these polls, I believe he knows exactly where he is and that he knows he is not winning this election unless he pulls whatever dirty trick he can pull out of a hat, because he is going around sounding like a scared man.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it seems that way, doesn't it? It does seem. As
to which I say, hooray! I hope he should be a scared man.
All right, let's talk about Peter Navarro before we go to a break at the bottom of the hour. Amid the Trump administration,
somebody good from the administration.
Yeah, there you go. Amid the Trump administration's troubled response to the coronavirus pandemic, senior White House aide Peter Navarro has refashioned himself as a powerful government purchasing chief, operating far beyond his original role as an advisor on trade policy. But U.S. officials say the abrasive figure's shortcomings as a manager could influence how well prepared the U.S. is for a second wave of coronavirus infections expected this fall. Navarro's harsh manner and disregard for protocol have alienated numerous numerous colleagues, corporate executives, and prominent Republicans. In a previously undisclosed incident, the White House Counsel's Office in 2018 investigated Navarro's behavior in response to repeated complaints and found he routinely had been verbally abusive toward others. Navarro narrowly avoided losing his job, but the abuse has continued as the White House has grappled with the pandemic, that according to multiple administration officials. On Monday, the administration terminated one contract that Navarro had directly negotiated for 42,900 Philips ventilators. A Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson said the cancellation was, quote, subject to internal HHS investigation and legal review. The contract had been criticized by a House Oversight Committee, which concluded that the government had overpaid for the ventilators by $500 million. That from the Washington Post. Jen Smith.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this is troubling. Instead of, you know, this is not how you want. And I think it's interesting, too, because this is not how, you know, from Republican pedagogy standpoint, you negotiate a deal at all. You know, you're supposed to negotiate a lower deal, not pay four times the price. And so, you know, I think, I don't know, it's I'm glad that this has come up, I think, but what's the actual response, and you know, how do you move on from that mistake that's already been made too?
Good point. Linda?
Well, when all is said and done, there is no news in this news. What we're talking about is another unqualified, ignorant, vulgar, lying, cheating, toxic bully in the service of an unqualified, vulgar, lying, cheating, toxic bully in the White House. I mean, he has gotten away with this stuff because he has Trump's support. And in the Washington Post piece, Tony Fratto, who was a deputy White House press secretary under George W. Bush, said, well, he speaks the president's language, and I don't know what to say. I guess since Trump refers to him as my Peter, I guess he does speak this president's language.
Ira.
As Letterman used to say to Paul Schaefer, Linda has crystallized my thoughts exactly. This is a guy who looks in the mirror and sees Trump, and Trump looks in the mirror and sees Navarro, and they're hand in hand. But as soon as something happens that accrues negatively to Trump, Navarro will be gone. And whether or not that's a critical mistake in his performance of his duties, or whether somebody is going to finally go to human resources about him, he'll hang on. But this is one of those guys, when you see him on the Sunday morning shows, you want to throw a shoe at the TV set.
Yeah, it's hard not to. I had a student ask me the other day in class if I was saying, you know, that people now they have social media and they can grumble there, but in the old days we just had to throw shoes at our TV sets. And one student raised her hand and said, did that really happen? And I said, oh, yes, all the time. Absolutely. Shoes, bricks, all kinds of stuff. Let's see.
Well, I can top that.
Yes.
I can top that. While I was covering the Congress for NBC News in the 70s, I threw a television out the second story window. I got so mad.
Do you remember the incident?
Now I use my dog chew toys, which are soft, you know, the soft ones, to throw at the TV when I turn it on.
Do you remember the incident that compelled you to throw the television out the window?
Well, it was two things. It was I didn't like what I was watching, and the other thing was I was trying to have an argument with the man to whom I was married, and he was watching the television instead of listening to me. So I walked over and unplugged it and opened the window and threw it out. And the next morning I went out and I got it, and it was cracked all across the front, but it still worked. And that was when I first learned you can't kill television.
They don't make them like that anymore.
No, they don't. Bob Brightson says, since the earliest poll closings will be in the Northeast, which is overwhelmingly Democratic, I don't see those states' relatively few Republican voters creating even the appearance of a Trump win. Do you?
Pennsylvania is in the Northeast.
Yeah, and big questions about Pennsylvania. Susan says, I asked this, if I send in an absentee ballot, but then I decide to go out and vote, what happens? They told me that the in-person vote will automatically cancel the absentee ballot. That is my understanding. We looked this up. Since the absentee ballots, this is my understanding of it anyway, that and correct me if I'm wrong, but that the absentee ballots are counted after the ballots at the polls are counted, and if it is seen that they're already has been a vote registered in your name on a machine, then the absentee ballot is then discarded. Although one of the things that I heard in some of the commentary about the president's remarks in regards to voting twice in North Carolina was that that may be a strategy of his as well to, while this, if the election goes on and is in court and so forth, that he will say, regardless of the circumstances, yes, and 250,000 votes in this area were tossed out, even though it's because they voted twice. Yes.
Yeah, I could see that rhetoric happening. I think the big thing, and I think that's exactly right. That's sort of the fail-safe that was explained to me as I was covering primary stuff in Massachusetts. The other thing, though, I think, that in Massachusetts postmortem of the primary is making sure that, you know, if you're getting a mail-in ballot, that it gets there, it gets to the person on time, and that it's also complete. There were reports in some parts of our state where people were missing like the send back envelope or other things. There's still a lot of work to be done. It's not a perfect system by any means.
No, not at all. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters. We have many more topics to discuss. We have Jen, are you leaving us? Do you have to leave at the bottom?
I do. I have to go to school.
It's like Survivor. We voted two off the island. It's going to be Ira and Linda when we come back. So we'll continue.
I have
with
full
those
confidence
two.
In them.
We'll be back right after
Bye,
this.
Bye, Jen.
Good morning. Welcome back to the panel and our discussion this morning. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. With us this morning, the sole survivors, Ira Fussfeld and Linda Ellerby. And again, of course, we welcome your letters. We go to Roseanne, who says, election night does not scare me as to what Ira said. I agree if on election night it's showing Trump is way ahead, he will say he's a winner. That's why I'm telling friends, you need to physically go and vote if you can. Biden needs to be way ahead on election night. Otherwise, a civil war will be started. That from Roseanne. Susan said, I asked this, if I send in an absentee ballot. Oh, I think we had a question very similar to that, so I'll skip that one. Larry says, when it comes to the vaccine, I'll have what the Europeans are having, thank you. Steven says, our tyrannical president is refusing to allow the U.S. to join the global effort to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. Unfortunately, we'll still with stupid Trump and can't be sure that the U.S. will have access to the best and safest vaccine in the world when it is indeed ready. Then we go to this letter from KC, who is talking about the Trump-Cuomo feud, saying Cuomo has reason to be angry. New York pays a bulk of the money that funds the Fed, and Trump threatens to cut what comes back to us, ? All right, let's move on to other topics and talk about other things.
Joe, before
yes,
we do, could I
please.
Just make one comment on the voting twice issue?
Of course.
I mean, yes, it's ridiculous, but
I should have gone ahead and say there's never been a time that's more important that we do vote. But we must remember that the voting is huge and there will be barriers to it, but that voting, in the end, democracy is not in the voting, it's in the counting. And if you don't understand that, you can look it up under presidential race 2000, Bush versus Gore, Florida.
Right.
Or you could just Google, and I guess some of us actually aren't old enough to remember that. My God, that's 20 years ago. Just Google hanging Chad.
Yes.
See how important the counting is.
It
and
is.
So this voting twice thing is a wonderful way to throw disputes into votes.
Here's an interesting little tidbit of information. The U.S. government debt will nearly equal the size of the entire economy for the first time since World War II, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The rapid change is largely due to the surge in new spending that the government authorized as it tried to control the economic impact of the coronavirus pandemic. By the end of 2020, the amount of debt owed by the U.S. will amount to 98% of the nation's gross domestic product, according to the CBO. That is up from 79% last year. Total government debt will surpass the U.S. economy's size next year. Fueling this rise is a big jump in the government's annual budget deficit, which is projected to widen to $3.3 trillion by the end of this fiscal year, more than triple its level in 2019. The deficit was already on track to be elevated because of recent tax cuts and spending increases, but the government's response to the pandemic expanded that gap dramatically. Remember, Ira, when Republicans and even other people used to care about those kinds of things?
I do, and as you point out, a lot of the elevation recently has been because of the pandemic and the trillions of dollars that was spent on that, and there's going to be more trillions spent down the road. It's hard to imagine that there won't be an agreement soon as another quote-unquote bailout. But this is all of a sudden, go back to the Tea Party when this was their issue, and that was not all that long ago. The debt is incredible. I will say it's difficult to ask a journalist, or in my case, a retired journalist, about money issues because we can't add. But I know enough to know that the tax cuts are not the way to go.
I'm with Ira on that.
That there are a lot of people in this country, and maybe even myself, and I'd be on the low end, that ought to be paying more money in taxes.
Linda?
Well, I'm a journalist, therefore I can't add either, believe me. But, you know, the deficit isn't in itself a terrible thing. Economic policy, the monetary system, our banking system, all of this was revised by Roosevelt in response to the Great Depression, changing all the rules that were under Hoover. If the Hoover rules were in effect right now, we would already be in a Great Depression with this deficit and this debt, because of this current situation. But, you know, deficits that are not a problem if they're emergency. World War II, Korean War, Vietnam, they were all run up. As long as you don't run them up indefinitely, it's not a big problem. It never was, since Roosevelt. But, Ira, I know you will relate to this. It's not an issue you want to campaign on.
No.
When you get out there, you say deficit or debt, half the people you're talking to will doze off, including the reporters. So what's a better issue in a presidential campaign? The deficit for Trump, it's, you know, a reckless, racist Republican in charge. Is the deficit or fear a better campaign thing? He's pushing fear of Biden. Democrats are pushing, you know, fear of what Trump might do. Nobody's going to be talking about the deficit during the campaign.
Except if the door remains open on issues like overhauling Obamacare, or even more than that, somehow impacting Social Security. If these issues become front and center, it's going to widen to talk about the entire government spending and taxing policy. And I'm not sure which side would benefit from that argument, but if it's done in a relatable way, people are going to recognize, hopefully, that you can't sustain a deficit as large as the one we have that is likely to get larger.
And you both touched on this, Linda, but go ahead.
Go ahead. No,
I was just going to say, I mean, you both touched on it, but we also have the possibility of, like, well, not the possibility, the reality that we have new jobless numbers out today. This problem over the next 2 months of people out of work and the economy, something's going to have to happen, right? I mean, if the president still is running on a great economy, whether it was lost because of the virus or not, as he indicates, something has to be done, and if you do that, you're just furthering the issue. I don't know how either side grasps that to be a winning strategy.
Well, if Biden wins the election, he is going to get for his great fortune an economy that is just in the toilet. I mean, if the thousands of people unemployed, thousands of small businesses closing, probably for good, and depending on when the virus is in control, thousands more to come. I don't know how you govern under those circumstances without expanding the deficit.
Right.
So I don't envy Biden. I'm rooting for him, but I don't envy him.
But as this, yeah, go ahead, Linda.
No.
I was just saying, as this division goes on, though, will anything happen between now and Election Day to help the people?
Well, that's
in
a different question.
Yeah. Go ahead, Linda.
I was just going to say, that's a different question. I go back to the fact that the words, first of all, taking down Obamacare is not because of the deficit. It's because he promised to do it and wants to keep his promise. And he ran on that point. I agree with what you're saying, Ira. However, I mean, it comes back to he's pushing fear of what happens to the economy if Biden is elected, what happens to the suburb, what happens if this, everything that has happened, all of this has happened, is happening on Trump's watch. Mm. And it is time for all of us to quote Ronald Reagan in 1976 when he ran against Jimmy Carter successfully with the phrase, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" And I challenge any person walking around in America right now, unless you're a billionaire, you know, or wealthy, to say yes. How can that possibly be? We should be saying, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? No, we're not. Biden is going to inherit terrible problems, but Biden is not the one who brought them on.
Now, isn't it classic, the photo either yesterday or the day before when Trump visited Kenosha, and he's standing there in front of a burned-out building, and he's saying, "This is not going to happen. This would have happened if Biden was the president." When, of course, it, as you point out, it has happened, and Trump is the president. And how's he going to fix it?
Right, and there's some questions about that whole scene too, as to how it was relayed. So let us end this morning in our last 3 or 4 minutes together and talk about Kamala Harris. The Biden campaign is deploying her as an ambassador to black activists. And this is the role that she has on going forward in the presidential campaign. Biden is seeking to energize African-American voters by embracing the Black Lives Matter movement while simultaneously reassuring white swing voters that he is not a radical activist. As part of that strategy, Harris has become an ambassador to the black community, sometimes praising Biden's racial justice plans, sometimes listening, other times simply urging African-Americans to vote. In the past week, Harris has spoken at the launch of a black women's group in Michigan, made a virtual appearance at the Get Your Knee Off Our Necks commitment march on Washington, and held a private call with about 100 black male leaders, including civil rights lawyer Benjamin Crump. The appearances are often unannounced and unpublicized, a direct pipeline to black voters that takes advantage of Harris's status as an African-American woman who shares many of her listeners' challenges. Linda, what do you make of this strategy?
Well, I why would she not be reaching out to black voters? That is in her job description, is it not? I mean, are we trying to say the fact that she is a black woman had nothing to do with the fact that she's on the ticket? If she reaches out, she's also a woman. If she's reaching out to me, I am not offended. her message is trying to assure black voters that Biden will still be hear their voices after he's in the White House. And that's a good message.
Ira?
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, in the great history of this country, the vice presidential candidate is chosen for his or her ability to reach out to particular constituencies. And it's clear that Harris can appeal to the black community. She can also appeal to the law enforcement community. If you go back and look at her time as an attorney general in California, in fact, it's been said that some black people are wary of her because they didn't think she did enough on their behalf when she was attorney general. But part of the calculation when you choose a running mate is what areas do I need shoring up in? I think what's interesting, I heard a statistic, and I may get the numbers wrong, but that that Trump, who had, I believe, 9% support among black people, has more than that so far in the polling. It's not significantly more. It may be 12 or 13%, but it's stunning to me that his appeal in the black community and the Latino community would go up, despite all of what has happened these last 4 years and all of his rhetoric. Although that seems like a little sliver, he, meaning Biden, needs every single one of those votes. Yeah. And if he's lost them somehow, Kamala Harris will help get them back, hopefully.
We are out of time. My thanks to both of you, Linda Ellerbe and Ira Fussfeld. It's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be on with you, Linda.
You too, Ira.
Thank you very much to you both. Coming up next is the Congressional Corner. We'll be right back after this.